my first love was always movies, and the amount of entertainment that I derived from the theatrical experience, it was like going to church for me.
Welcome to Story and Craft. Now, here's your host, Mark Preston.
Well, welcome back. How are you? I'm Mark Preston, and this is Story and Craft, and I am so jazzed that you are back. If you've checked out previous episodes, thank you for returning and checking out another episode. And if you are new to the show, welcome. I promise I won't stink up the joint. You'll enjoy yourself, I promise. And I tell you, this week we have a great episode. A guy named Chris Baker, you may know him from YouTube, or maybe not, but he has got his very first feature-length film out. It's on Hulu. It's called The Estate, and he wrote it. And he is the lead actor in it, and it's a really cool conversation about movie making and how to kind of create your own thing and get it out into the world. And anybody who's an actor or a creative, you know we're living in a very cool era where you can create your thing and get it into the world. The inspiration's right here with a guy who got it done. Again, Chris Baker, so glad to have him this week, and I'm jazzed to bring him to you. It's a great conversation. And don't forget, storyandcraftpod.com. Once again, storyandcraftpod.com. Check it out. All kinds of good stuff about the show. You can learn about me if you so desire, social media links. Of course, you can send me a note if you would like, or you can also leave a voicemail. Kind of cool. Once again, storyandcraftpod.com. And please, by all means, subscribe, like, leave a review. Very super cool if you could do that. High five, 5 stars, whatever else you would like to do to kind of spread the word. Tell a friend. You know, we got some cool episodes in the library already. Some very cool episodes on the way. But this week, right now, it's Chris Baker Day right here on Story and Craft.
Just so you know, I am in Mammoth right now. And my husband and all of his friends at some point will be walking, not through here, but in the house that we're staying in. And they're
totally fine.
And when that happens, I will let you know. When I hear it, you'll let me know if you hear it, and then we'll be good.
Hey, you know, that makes it more interesting. Probably hear my daughter texting me right now, so it's like I got to put that on mute. But man, congratulations, by the way, on the film. What an accomplishment. I don't care who you are, to write something and to also get it on. Now, I mean, all the different things that have to go right before you get a movie into the theaters, I mean, all along the line. So congratulations on that. Definitely want to talk about the movie without a doubt. I watched it the other night. Sit down on my laptop and my sofa. I'm like, oh, a little mystery going on. And like within the first couple minutes, man, you were off to the races. I'm like, all right, this is what we're doing right now, man. So it's it was a lot of fun. I will say that. I had a blast. In fact, last night, I didn't, I saw you did the your YouTube series, the one about you being afraid to speak with somebody who is British because it affects your accent, it affects you. It rang so true. There was this girl in college, I remember, that anytime she had a little too much to drink, she suddenly put on a British accent. We don't know where it came from. So I was like, that just kind of resonated with me. It was hilarious. So that's had a lot of fun with that.
There's a name for it. I think there's a medical term for that girl and me.
Sorority, I think, is the term. But no. but no. Seriously though, congratulations, man. I have to say, I'm kind of getting introduced to you. But it's a pleasure, and it's a fun introduction because I didn't know about your web series, and I checked that out, and I noticed there it said a lot of the videos were not available yet. I was like, damn, you whet my appetite. I wanted to know more. I wanted to watch more. So
so with my web series that was called Baker Daily, what happened there was we did really well, and it was on Funny or Die and on YouTube. And it was about this very, I wrote it myself, and it was about a very inept cable news anchor who stumbles into impeaching Donald Trump with this explosive story that he finds about his wife and one of his daughters. And it was right around 2017, 2018 when it came out, and it was really well received and people were loving it. And then slowly there were some Trump people that found it. And then I think there was a whole Reddit thread about how they needed to find my address, and I started getting death threats. And I and my producers, we were kind of talking about it, and we thought that the best course of action would be to take it down for now. I would hope that it could live, but that is the story, and that is why currently it is not available anywhere, because I love comedy, and I love what I do. I do love my life just a little bit more.
I do like living, and that's a sad thing about things. You talk about a group of people, about Constitution and country and First Amendment, right there, and satire. Is I think comedy is one of the ways we kind of keep people honest in a way.
Yeah.
Going back to even George Carlin, boy, don't you wish George Carlin was still around, because he got it right, didn't he? But I was curious though with the movie and looking at the diversity between the video, the web series, and the movie, a little different, most certainly. But the thing about the through line is you have such a fun comedic. Like your timing is just so fun to watch. You know, there's some people that it is fun to watch as much as they are delivering lines, and I got a kick out of that. But when you were coming up, I mean, what were you like watching comedians? Who were your like North Stars when it came to inspiration and stuff?
Yeah, I grew up basically watching Seinfeld, Friends, and Sex and the City just about every day, and memorizing every single line, every single intonation, every single sort of thing about those characters. I also watched a lot, and even now, of Family Guy and South Park. When you talk about satire or parody truly ridiculousness that just takes it so far, and 30 Rock as well. So those TV shows were really important for me when I was growing up. But my first love was always movies, and the amount of entertainment that I derived from the theatrical experience, it was like going to church for me. And it truly was. It was a religious experience. And the longer I've been around, the longer I see there are less and less movies that where their aim is to entertain. And, you know, I think right now we have Marvel, and we have a lot of, I don't know how to put it, but like movies with a message. They're like message movies that are often independently made, that win a lot of awards, but no one goes to see. Or if people see them, they don't carry the same weight, and they don't have that life that can live and, you know, be aired on cable, you know, forever. I mean, the movies that I watched on HBO when I was way too young to see them were like My Best Friend's Wedding and The Net. There were just these movies that I thought were just there to divert people for 2 hours and just entertain you and just transport you.
Yeah, there's a zen to just getting out of your own head. And I think
wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, that's where I think Judd Apatow is sort of he's a prince of these kind of movies. I think there needs to be. I remember back when Chris, I can't remember. I think it's Chris also. I think it's his name. They did American Pie and all those. And I remember seeing an interview
I loved those movies.
Yeah, when they came out, I remember he was being interviewed. Well, some I like better than others, but he said, listen, there aren't any good rated R movies anymore, you know, and I remember him saying, this is an interview.
There's not a lot of sex in movies anymore either. I mean, I grew up watching, you know, this movie, The Estate, which is available on Hulu now, is heavily based on movies like Cruel Intentions and Wild Things, and there was a smaller film, but it was still, I think it was released by Sony many years ago, called Jawbreaker with Rose McGowan. And
oh my God, yeah.
These very campy, like crazy movies, but where the characters were manipulating each other with sex. And now when I see a lot of movies today, there's just not a lot of eroticism with movies. And I think that there's something about the availability of porn and the politics sort of changing, and also China and a lot of movies needing to open there as well as in the States. And we've just become a much more prudish society.
And isn't it kind of ironic because you think we become more liberal as the years go on? Yeah, I grew up in the late 80s, early 90s, and that was kind of the thing. I mean, all the movies that were coming out were unabashedly...
the erotic thriller.
Most certainly. It's sort of like you had Rodney Dangerfield and all that stuff, and you had when you say Cruel Intentions, it was not meant to be taken seriously. You're allowed to enjoy, kind of like grab a bottle of wine, sit down, enjoy these despicable human beings because it's just it's a ride. And I thought this was kind of, it's not a movie I typically seek out, but one of the things I think is a sign of great writing and character development and all that stuff is when you start empathizing with these people, you know, yourself. I don't want to do any spoilers here because, you know, I think everybody should jump over to Hulu and check this out. But it's not a kid movie. We're going to make it clear. It's not a family movie. No. But, not all movies should be, you know.
No. Yeah. No, I love the idea that this is a movie for adults and for adults to laugh at these ridiculous people that do things that they would never do and say things that they would never say. And there's a perverse enjoyment in watching characters do things that you would never do. And there's an escapism to that. And that's really why, you know, I write and why I perform. It's to entertain people and transport them. And yeah, that's something that the longer, you know, I've been looking at the Oscar conversation right now, and I've been trying to catch up on a lot of the movies and stuff. And I don't know how many people care about the Oscars anymore. I used to care a lot.
I think the Oscars used to be more of an event than it is.
Yeah.
Ricky Gervais got it right when he started just roasting the thing. I think Ricky Gervais is kind of like, we're taking ourselves a little bit too seriously here. You know.
And wasn't that fun to have people kind of be made fun of?
Indeed. Yeah. Well, the question I've got for you is, were you the first choice? You wrote The Estate, which is
in
itself. I fancy myself a budding screenwriter. I do it for a hobby and fun, but it's great to tell stories and craft them. And you see them. I don't know about you, but you see the movie in your head and you actually see the beats and all that. Were you writing it with the intent of I'm going to be in this movie, or were you writing this going, maybe I'll do it, maybe it's somebody else will be cast playing the part I played, or were you always like, this is something I'm writing for myself?
Yes, originally it was written with myself in mind, like as a continuation almost of the web series. Like that stuff that I did was based around a character that I created, and The Estate was very similar. If someone with, 10, 20, 30 times the original budget that we had for the movie, and they're like, this particular person needs to star in this film, otherwise, we're not going to make it. I would not have stood in the way of that progress. But, there are no gay movie stars. There are no, this film, I think, benefits from being a film and a story about a male guy who's gay, who's not coming out of the closet and who is not, contracting AIDS, which are the sort of right now, when you look at the landscape of everything that is in movies for gay actors, unless they're the, quippy sidekick, there's not a lot of stories or diversity of stories. And my whole thing was I really wanted, and I would have benefited from having this as a kid, a gay role that was an antihero.
Where you're not a caricature. You're actually movies back in the 70s, 80s. You know, when the Brat Pack came in, there was kind of that movies started shifting to focusing a little more on teens and younger. Now that's where everything is now. I've noticed some of those movies have caught the ones that are definitely geared towards under 25. It seems like they feature gay characters who are not characters. You know, they are definitely part of the fabric of what's going on. They're not a cliche, So I think there's got to be, do you think there's a little more progress with the younger folk in that
regard? Absolutely. Absolutely. There's Universal Pictures right now is, I think they already completed the film and it's being released this summer. It's called Bros and it's with Billy Eichner and he started and Judd Apatow is producing it and it has a lot of gay characters in it. And that's a really big deal. That's the first film of its kind. And there's a movie that was a Christmas film on Netflix that did really well called Single All the Way. And you know, there's at least three different TV shows with starring roles for gay men that I can think of just off the top of my head that were just created in the past couple of years. Things are changing, and I'm very proud that The Estate and other films like it are kind of part of a new crop where different people that usually didn't have their chance to tell their stories before or tell stories that featured people that were like them, that's growing and that's evolving. And I think the best part is that people are watching.
Did you see the movie Booksmart, by any chance?
Booksmart. I did, yeah.
You know, I thought it was sort of like, and my kids, my oldest is a freshman in college. My son's a senior. I have a younger one who's a sophomore in high school. And I noticed that that when I was in high school, I don't want to use the word novelty, but if somebody is gay, it's like, oh, well, that's kind of interesting. Well, now it's just not even thought about. It's just part of what it is. You know, so I think naturally the offshoot is when you watch movies like that, it's not held up as a cliche. What would we say, like in the 90s, be overly flamboyant character? They're comic relief as opposed to experiencing what everybody else is on their own terms.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And look, I want to, you know, I should make clear that there is no one that makes me laugh harder than Jack, the character on Will and Grace. That type of bitchy, horny, dumb, you know, looks obsessed, desperate for the spotlight, common stereotype of gay men is something that will never not make me laugh. And those stereotypes usually have some truth to them. And so I think that the way that those things really resonate is if they're actually funny and they're actually entertaining, and two, if they have a kernel of truth in them as well. So I think that, you know, there are definitely, the exception proves the rule, you know.
Well, as far as going back, who were you when you were watching movies when you were a kid? I know the movies you mentioned, but were there either characters, and Jack, of course, is one, but, or actors, you go, they're kind of like inspiration. There's nuggets you're taking from them, and you're like, man, something about them makes sense to you, and it's fun, and you like to catch every movie they're in. Who was that when you were growing up?
Oh my God, so many people. You know, movie stars, I worshipped at the altar of movie stars. I really did. You know, Brad Pitt and Gwyneth Paltrow and Ben Affleck and Matt Damon and Tom Cruise. Oh my gosh.
I mean you can't look at Brad Pitt. Any guy looks at Brad Pitt and everybody's got a man crush on him. I don't care if you're gay or not. You look at him and go, you know what? Once upon a time in Hollywood, you look at him and go, that's a dude right there. That's Hollywood right there in a nutshell.
And there's Julia Roberts and Sandra Bullock and, you know, just these people that I feel like were that descended from the heavens to change my life, that were made to, I would watch any movie of theirs and I would always be thankful. And, you know, I Julianne Moore was so good. I would watch her in anything and just be in awe every time. You know, anyone who was ever in Boogie Nights or Magnolia and Robert De Niro too. And there are a lot, but it's the ones that just changed the culture. And also, you know, they made great films, but they also kept their eye on making sure that they made movies that could be commercially successful so that they would please and entertain an audience. That was really, you know, that wasn't just this pursuit of artistic pleasure just solely for themselves. They wanted to do that for audiences. It was what their calling was.
As a writer, and of course you did the screenplay. Are you sort of like the of the school of thought that if they don't get all the words just quite right, is it like, I really want this to be, you know, kind of locked in, kind of like I'm brain farting right now again. But he wrote The West Wing.
Aaron Sorkin.
Word yeah, you know, he's right. Very. All the words are very measured and carry weight, and he wants them to be all in there. Are you like more like that, or are you more like, hey, I'm into improvisation?
I was into both. I think our, the director of the film, James Kapner, who, you know, I've known for years, who I collaborated with for so long. I think we both went into this feeling so lucky with the cast that we had. You know, Eric Roberts plays my father, and, you know, Eliza Coop from Happy Endings and on this new show that's on Fox right now called Pivoting, she plays my stepmother, and Greg Finley, who's, you know, been on all of these hunky TV shows for years, played the hitman that we hire. Then Heather Matarazzo, who's, you know, part of this great indie tradition of filmmaking. We were just so lucky to have these people that we sort of, without even saying anything, left it up to them. So if there were things in the moment that Eliza and I were playing off of each other.
And by the way, that relationship y'all have, I think watching this, it's worth watching just to see the relationship with the two of you. It's a well-executed hot mess. I will say that.
Y'all are biased to watch. Yeah, I'm biased, obviously, but we knew that we had something really special comedically when we would have to stop rolling the camera because the director of photography was laughing so hard that he was shaking the camera. you know, the fact that Eliza and I just really, we didn't know each other before this, and we met about the role. She didn't audition. You know, we were just talking about the role with her, and the chemistry that we had within literally 10 seconds of her sitting down was just so plainly evident that people were like, this is it. The role is hers, and she owned it. So back to your question, it depended on the person. And I think what we wanted was to make sure that the information in each scene came out, because it is structured as a mystery, and you want each piece to guide the audience along. But if there's something,
there's at least a good handful of times I'm like, I don't know where this is. Though I didn't know it was going there. And how often do you watch a movie now? You're like, you can just see the trailer and go, I know basically what's going to happen in this movie. You know, a lot of romantic comedies like this. If somebody watches this, says, oh, I know where this is going, they're wrong, you know, which is kind of fun, you know, to be taken on that. Like I said at the outset, you kind of go on a ride in this movie. So,
and not easy to do. You know, I think that we really made sure, and it took a while to find that magic where we were not kind of like showing so much exposition and detailing so much for the audience that we were just kind of, you know, talking at them rather than making them feel where this story was going and feel where the actors and the characters would show on screen, that they had to make these decisions, that they had to go to those places.
You know, anytime Eric Roberts shows up in a movie, it's just like, you know, it's going to get good in a moment. Not that it wasn't good already. It's just, you know, Eric Roberts brings kind of his own kind of special sauce to things, you know, which was, you know, and there are things I want to discuss. I'm like, but if I do, it'll be a spoiler. Don't want to do that. But when you, as far as the inspiration for this, was there, you talked about the movie, like Cruel Intentions and things like that. Had you sat down and thought, I want to make a movie in that tone, in that vibe? Or were you just kind of like blank slate? Or what inspired you to kind of sit down in front of your editor or your word processor and start typing this up?
That's a good question. The best way I can answer it is this. I thought that something was lost in movies, and I wanted to create a movie that I wish existed. And it would be something that was campy and fun, but kind of dirty and sexy and a little perverted and naughty and violent and all of these sort of things that I felt like really weren't a part of movies very often anymore. And the best way that I thought that could make these characters do all of these horrible things is money, because when you look at our society today, people are less and less religious. People are more politically, identified. But after my experience with the web series, I definitely didn't want to touch anything political.
After that, it's probably like you're staying not even in the same zip code of anything that's going to work. Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing that people seem to worship, no matter who they are, no matter where they're from, no matter what their gender identity is, no matter what their sexuality is, no matter what their race is, or class is money. White people, black people, rich people, poor people.
Well, you also touched on the whole status thing.
Yeah.
Again, it's not a family movie, but I mean, come on, this is a pure like date night bottle of wine, just kick back. And I mean, it's on Hulu. It's easily accessible, of course. But when were you coming? Did you come from a family that was creatively inclined, or are you kind of the first one in the family to kind of jump into this pool?
The very, very first one. Yeah. I was a little good student, and I worked really hard in school, and I ended up going to a great college, and I was studying film while I was there, and so I think it was always a foregone conclusion that I would be doing this, but it took these different turns. But my family was always very appreciative of the arts and loved.
So you had the support. You had, in other words, this was not like, what are you doing? Yeah, choose a more sensible gig. You know, what are you doing? They were getting behind you.
No, yeah. To know me is to know that there was no other path for me. So I think my parents and, you know, my older sister, they looked at me and they're like, this is it. You know, he's not going to flip the script and go to dental school. You know, it's just not in the cards. So, you know, if he's going to do this, then we just really wish him the best. They hadn't, you know, they had no idea how to help me. And, you know, I moved here with no connections, or, you know, to LA with no, like, anything in my wheelhouse that could help me.
Where are you from originally, though?
New York City.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, that's still, you know, you're not coming from, you know, Topeka, Kansas.
No, it was a lot more stage. Yeah, it was a lot more stage and sort of musical theater type people, which was not my bag. Even though I'm gay, I don't know why musical theater just, I can appreciate it, but it's not something that, you know, just works for me. It was always just movies. So the idea that I would start from scratch happened with my first opportunity, which was reading scripts and watching films that didn't have distribution yet as an intern for the Weinstein Company, which was quite an eye-opening experience.
Oh, I'm sure. Many, many levels. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know, I did retail for years and, you know, and in that in of itself is sort of a performance, for each person.
That's my 16-year-old daughter. Whenever I go to eat, she's, you know, she seems enamored by working at a restaurant. I'm like, you know, do what you want. I mean, I think everyone should work in the service industry or retail 100%. At least once, you know,
100%.
What do you think about the transition to, people watching more at home? Naturally, over the last couple of years, it's got to be where it's at. But it used to be, if you were a TV actor, you're a TV actor. You're not crossing over in the film. Back in the era you're talking about, you'd rarely see that happen. Now, nobody cares. You're going film, TV, and the blurs the lines of what TV is anymore. What do you think about that kind of change and things being consumable at home without having to go to the theater? Or do you miss the big releases on a big screen?
It's a complicated question, and I'm afraid it has a complicated answer. I think change like this for this industry is neither good nor bad. It just is. The most important thing is that people are watching. I do think that movies suffered, and because people, in my opinion, were burned over and over and over and over again, paying single tickets to watch a film, either in the theater or on demand.
It's kind of like the buying CDs back in the day, maybe spending $25 on a CD, only one song is good. Yeah, that feeling. But yeah, absolutely.
In my opinion, it wasn't just the ease and the streaming giants, you know, the tech giants, you know, trying to squeeze out the theatrical experience. I also think that the public soured on the movies because the movies were not as entertaining as they were before. And the movies that are really there with the huge budgets, that are there to entertain solely, are the ones that are doing the best now. And the ones that...
Would you say it's more the safe choices they're taking? The safe route? That, yeah.
And the family films where it's a whole outing for the whole family. You know, and that makes a lot of sense. The four quadrant ones, but the movies that had smaller audiences, even before COVID, were finding their audiences when they arrived on a streamer, not when they were released day and date on demand and in theaters, or once they won awards. It was always when they were on a streamer and people were scrolling through.
So you think kind of the COVID maybe changed, kind of accelerated something that was already in play, do you think?
Yes, absolutely.
People were moving that direction anyway.
Yes, there's no doubt. And I also think that if you're going to have everything available for everyone forever, there is a lot of older stuff that many people haven't seen still that can be better than what's currently available now. So there's when you're at a theater, you see the marquee and there are like five names. And so more or less in that area where the theater is serving, the public is sort of choosing between those five movies, right? When you're on your couch, you have 100 different apps with thousands of movies and thousands of TV shows to choose from, not to mention your phone, which has multiple social media networks and constant video content as well. So if someone is actually getting your attention enough for you to click on the thing, and then you're actually watching it long enough all the way through in one sitting, I mean, that's a miracle in and of itself. It really is. So I prefer still to this day, if a movie is worth my time, although it's always a gamble, let's be honest. if you're going to take a chance on a film, I would rather have the phone away. I would rather have the popcorn and I would either go alone or with some friends or with my family or something and sit and watch it and be enveloped by the screen and kind of have it wash over you and sort of be transported.
Yeah. It's a strangely communal kind of a thing. I just, seeing movies in a theater. I think as Spielberg said something that we're entering an era where the only movies that will show up in theaters are going to be the big blockbusters, are going to be hanging out in theaters for a long time. Now it's like something's in the theater. I'm like, oh, I got to see that. Oh, it's already out of the theater, you know? But I think streaming, for me, it's I like being able to find those gems. It's like things that I never would have found otherwise. And, you know, I think it almost gets into not a niche necessarily, but things that are like, I know I can watch this and I'll really like it. And probably my kids may or may not, or it's a little bit more of a personal kind of a relationship because you can access, like you said, thousands of movies. So if you can't find something you like, maybe go make it, but that's kind of the thing also that you think, do you think that what you did, which I mean, again, congratulations, because getting, writing something, getting it, getting all those little pieces to fall into place to get something bought, to get something out there is, it's not an easy task. But to me, it represents what I hope more people will glean from it. If something's not out there, or you don't think you're getting cast or, whatever, go out there, create something on your own. And that's easier said than done. I know, as I'm sure you know better than anybody, but, by the way, I'm sorry, we have a little audience member back here, my golden retriever.
I love the golden retriever.
Oh, he's a sweetheart. Yeah. But what do you think about the idea of, for those who are kind of in that cycle, I've acted on camera a number of times, and I was talking with somebody the other day. I said, I would love to do stuff on camera. I'm just so busy doing what I'm doing. I don't have a chance to kind of block off 3 hours out of my day to get to the casting director's office, do the thing, come back, or, you know. He said, man, and this is a pretty successful actor. He said, dude, everything's being recorded. Everything's being self-taped at home now. I was like, another COVID thing that maybe worked to the advantage of our industry. But for people that want to kind of get out of that cycle of just auditioning, just asking for gigs, what would your advice be as far as creating, you know, as far as somebody's got an idea, how would you suggest they approach that if they want to make something of their own?
I would say one, you have to find people that are going to be honest with you. And you have to have a really thick skin for when you perform for the first time and send that to someone, or if you write something for the first time or direct something for the first time and send it off to someone, or have a, you know, exhibit it to people. You have to be willing to know that this is a journey and you're going to get better. My first script was not good at all. And even after multiple drafts, it was still kind of middling. To understand the structure and how I wanted an audience to feel when I was writing The Estate, that took a few years. and to, you know, pull the rug out from under an audience for that twist ending that kind of flips the script and sort of informs and answers every question that people may have had while they were watching the film the whole time. That takes a long time to kind of develop. And I think that sometimes people have a story about their childhood or about their life experience that when they write it, it just sort of comes out fully formed. And then other times people, if they're thinking about science fiction or something more fantastical, that world building and stuff, all of that takes time. So I think patience is really important too. And the other thing is, in independent film, the number one thing I can say from all the talks that I had with producers for the film over the years, and you know how many calls need to be made or whatever, is make sure you have access to money.
Easier said than done. Yeah. Yes. That's, well, I mean, of course, the other thing I think I've noticed is I remember reading the book, actually listened to the audiobook of Save the Cat. Yeah. You read the book on screen.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's the idea that you got to get rid of, if not find it so, just don't marry yourself so much to an idea. If it doesn't work, be okay throwing it away, starting over, you know. I remember a story the writer was talking about that some people come to him for advice and him break down the script. Here's all the things that work. Here's the things that don't work. And it's going to involve basically tearing that whole script up and starting for, and how many people are not willing to do that? You got to be willing to do that, you know, if you believe
right.
it. But this is the first time you've done something as far as the creative input and of this scale. What are a couple of the biggest lessons you learned, epiphanies? Like you thought it was going to be like this and then you're like, oh, well, it didn't quite go that way. Maybe it's a happy accident. What did you learn in this process?
The best lesson that I learned throughout the process, even though I was the sole screenwriter and I was the main character in the film, is that film itself is the most collaborative art form that exists. The number of people and the number of different points of view, from the gaffer to the prop master to all the different one-line parts that we had in the film, to the weather that day, you know, which I guess is if you believe in God, is just, you know, all were a part of making a movie, the movie that it ends up being. And no matter how good intentioned or how important one person's voice or one person's point of view is, it has to be a collaboration. And I think everyone has to have the same goal. So everyone on set and in the editing room and everyone that worked on this film and worked really hard for not a lot of money, everyone had the goal of entertaining an audience and creating this neon-soaked, naughty kind of truly, you know, fairy tale nightmare.
I love that neon soaked thing. That's so, it's like, if I can encapsulate the 80s for my kids, it's so yeah. funny. The, you know, the whole, oh God, I don't even know, but neon soaked. I got to remember that one. But yeah, like we're watching Stranger Things, the music, the vibe, it was a lot more, like you said, movies, comedians, things like that could happen then. Ironically, you couldn't bring a lot of that back now. That's why this is a fun ride, and that's why I think this does bring forward that kind of thing that we don't see too much anymore. Hopefully we'll see it more. I mean, I'd like to see kind of a resurgence of movies that are quite frankly made for adults, you know.
Yes. Absolutely. I think that I choose to believe that there's a real hunger for it. There are a lot of TV shows that are, you know, a longer form movie, honestly, but it's like a 10-hour movie. And a lot of people don't have that much time. Or, you know, when you're making a 10-hour film that's a 10-part miniseries instead of a 90-minute feature, sometimes to fill all of that time, you have to add in backstory, side characters and their sort of storylines that sometimes don't work as well as the main storyline. And, you know, building out a world doesn't necessarily have to be maximalist to in terms of time and volume. Sometimes it is about really zeroing in and making something that is a sub 2 hour experience for people that they can really enjoy and get in and get out.
Yeah. Was this something you would do? You're wanting to do again, writing a movie, acting it, or you know, it's a lot of work. You know, are you kind of more wanting to go through just being in someone else's project? If you had a good situation, like I want my next project to be this kind of project, this kind of thing, this kind of director, you know, or co-stars. What? How would you envision that?
Well, my next script is already finished. I actually wrote it with another writer who's so incredibly hilarious. His name is Jared Grody. And it is a wedding themed rom-com. And it is, you know, it's definitely not as dark as The Estate, but it has it has a more, I think, more commercial appeal, but also still very much for adults. And it has elements of all of my favorite romantic comedies growing up, and also movies like American Pie and The Birdcage, and just these films that just also, like many others, really influenced me. And so it was kind of put it in a blender, and that's what this romantic comedy is. And it's in development right now. I'm sure you know pretty well that in development can mean a whole range of things. So we're
waiting. It can change at a moment's notice. Yeah.
Change, absolutely. So I'm of the headspace that I would love to see that project get made next. I have other projects as well that I'm working on, but that is the thing that's furthest along and that I'm so, so proud of. And I just,
well, as far as like a director, who would you love to work with? Who would you love to direct you based on the movies you've seen? And if you'd, a script came in and said, hey, so-and-so's attached as the director.
David Fincher.
Oh, really? Oh, look at you go. Yeah. That's so you're that is very much down the middle of what we're talking about here. Yeah.
He's my number one of all time. Yeah. I love Scorsese obviously as well. I love PTA. I love Tarantino.
I was going to ask you about Quentin Tarantino, because something about like his sensibility and what he does seems like it would resonate with you.
Absolutely. And you know, there are people like Adrian Lyne and Brian De Palma who, you know, I know that decades ago had such a, you know, with where they're Paul Verhoeven. Oh, I love Paul Verhoeven. You know, but I think there's something about David Fincher that the first film of his that I saw, I think, was The Game. And then I was desperate to see Fight Club when it was in theaters, but I was way too young. And my parents just plainly refused. But I went to Sam Goody.
Are you talking about The Game, the Michael Douglas movie?
The Game with Michael Douglas and Sean Penn.
Oh, that was great.
Edward Carr Unger, and just a really, really great cast. And there's no one that I think, there's no American filmmaker that I think encapsulates what film is and what a person can be truthful to about themselves and with the world and how they reckon with the modern world. I think that his films, Gone Girl was hugely influential on me when I was making, you know, The Estate, and how I thought about how terrible characters can treat each other and how they can manipulate each other and the plans that they can have to sort of thwart people. But a lot of it is out of love. There, you know, Seven is just, you know, just a perfectly encapsulated, tight film. You know, Fight Club literally taught all, you know, an entire generation of millennial men how to go from being boys to men.
I'm seeing Brad Pitt show up a couple times in the movies you're mentioning here. Yeah.
Yes.
It's nice to see somebody at his level that's got the goods. You know, it's not just, you know, Mr., you know, handsome Hollywood star. Yeah. He's got the stuff, you know, he brings it and everything.
When I've read things about him, you know, I think Ad Astra, before Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Ad Astra was the last movie I think that he produced that was released in theaters. He just really, really, really loves movies. And he respects the art form. And, you know, De Niro is the same. And those people, there are very few of those people. I think Russell Crowe is one of them. I think Harrison Ford was one of them for like 50 years, you know, just hitting it out of the park over and over and over again. The Fugitive is one of my favorite films of all time. And, you know, I could go on and on and on about Harrison Ford. My dog is named Dr. Richard Kimball. So I think that there are, you know, there are just these people that I would die to work with. But in terms of directors, David Fincher is the number one top.
Well, if we look at the tone of the movie of The Estate, let's say you were to craft another movie similar tone, like these movies we're talking about.
Yeah.
Who would be kind of a very, very, very short list of actors that you think would be great and fun to kind of play with for, you know, a few months making a film like that?
Oh my gosh. Dream scenario. I love Anne Hathaway. I think that she's a genius and I'm just obsessed with her. I really, really love Charlize Theron. I think Theron. And I think that everything she does is so interesting. I've probably seen Young Adult.
She's a great comedic actress also. That movie she did with Seth Rogen, where she played a...
Oh, right.
Her timing is just on point, you know?
Yeah. And you know, Mad Max, and when she was in Prometheus, I mean, these roles where her looks inform her characters in just, I don't know if she's just really, really good at picking roles for herself, and she just understands her arsenal of you know, tricks and whatever so well. I'm just continually impressed by her. And I would really, really love to work with... I love Mindy Kaling. I like her new show a lot. There are just a lot of people out there. I mean, I've named all women, but obviously Brad Pitt is just the number one of all time, because I think, you know, I feel like I just learn a lot from him. I think that he's just, he's lived a very interesting life, but he's also made a lot of great movies. So,
yeah. He never phones it in, without a doubt. And we can
and you
probably.
Can't be David Fincher. You cannot be a David Fincher fan without being a Brad Pitt fan as well.
Well, you know, as we wrap up, I'm just kind of curious, what are you watching right now, like TV wise? What are you consuming on that you're just like, that's your entertainment?
Well, in terms of scripted, I saw there's a film called The Card Counter with Oscar Isaac that I really enjoyed. I thought it was a very strange and beautiful and kind of stoic meditation on like the state of the modern man, you know. I thought it was fantastic. And I saw The Lost Daughter with Olivia Colman. That was really, really good. I loved Yellow Jackets, which I'm almost done with. That Showtime show.
I've been meaning to catch that.
I just kept being recommended it, and I was finally like, you know what, I'm just going to start it. And my husband and I just can't stop devouring it. Ozark is one of our favorite shows, and we're very happy that that's back on. But the thing, unfortunately, that I watch the most, well, maybe not unfortunately anymore, but are The Housewives, Vanderpump Rules, Summer House, Below Deck, every iteration of Below Deck.
The bottom line is you need that departure. I mean, it's a lot of stuff I don't watch, but I have my own escapism, and that's something that and I think that's been very clarified, at least in this country, in the U.S. over the last handful of years, we've needed that escapism. You know, when you turn off the news, you know.
When I'm watching a scripted show, unless it's really, 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 really good, like Ozark or Yellow Jackets, or, you know, I love Mare of Easttown. That was fabulous. As a writer watching most scripted stuff, I'm usually watching the gears shift as each scene plays out. And if it's not very good, I can't get into it. I'm just watching the machinations. So the thing about reality television is that even though it is sort of just as scripted as many other things, there's just a strangeness about the human condition that is truly revealed by these people that decide to open up their homes and lives to all of the world. And it does feel, when I'm watching those shows, like brain cleaner, where I really don't have to think a lot. And I can just kind of check out and just read into the human experience in a...
You know, what was that show? You're probably going to know what I'm talking about. There was a show, it may have been... I don't know when I caught it. It was a scripted show about making something like The Bachelorette. It was a drama.
Unreal.
I got to be honest with you, that pulled me in. That was kind of when you really, because when you've worked on sets and you just even the PAs with walking around with the walkie talkie, you get a sense of like
twists and turns.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Indeed. So it's like you start realizing that a lot of these shows. They went from calling reality. Now they're called, what do they call them? Unscripted shows, you know. But there is still theater to them, but it's just a different kind of theater, you know. But what I'm going to, as we wrap up here, and again, thank you for being generous with your time. I certainly appreciate it. But I got something. I call it Preston's Lucky Seven. I like to ask seven questions. I like to ask questions. I used to do this when I had a syndicated radio show many moons ago on ABC. But what is your favorite comfort food?
Anything chocolate.
You and my oldest daughter get along very, very well. If there's nothing in the house chocolate, there's a collective sigh like, oh, no. Now, who are three people, if you could sit down for a cup of coffee, could be living or dead, who would you want to sit down with and at that table of four people, you and three others, who would you like to sit down with and chat?
Barack Obama, David Sedaris, and Michelle Pfeiffer.
That's an interesting table. You know, it'd be more fun, actually, instead of coffee, have some beers, you know? Kind of cutlery. Something tells me, the president would be down with that.
Yeah.
Now, who was your celebrity crush when you were a kid?
Oh, well, you know, Brad Pitt. Yeah. Oh, there was a guy on the OC... that I think his, no, I know, his name is Chris Carmack. I don't know, I think he's on Grey's Anatomy now, but I don't watch Grey's Anatomy. I was in love with him. And I love that show. I just ate that show up. But I couldn't believe someone like that physically could exist. And he played a very stupid character, and I always found that very attractive. But, yeah.
It's funny, you mentioned Grey's Anatomy, I remember sitting down with Patrick Dempsey for a movie. God, it was called, was it With Honors? It was years ago. Brendan Fraser was in it. And so I sat down with him. I'm sitting there looking at this guy going, this guy's on the precipice, man. He's this guy. He's the nicest guy, but he's got this cool about him. And here he is, Dr. McDreamy years later, you know. So now, if you were to define, next question, what would be perfect day for you? Get up. Day starts great from stem to stern. What would be a perfect day for you? What would be the component parts of that?
Perfect day is waking up real, like right after sunrise, walking my dog, then doing a workout of some kind and kind of getting all that stress and whatever I drank the night before out of my system and sweating that out. And then writing some really, really, really great, great scenes with great crackling dialogue that there's just no better drug than that. And then going out for pasta with my husband. Yeah.
Got to get those carbs in. That's, hey man, I'm getting a little older, man. I got to keep an eye out for that, but I'll do it still. I don't mind a couple of pounds. Sure. Why not? Now, if you're going to be on an island and you're bringing one album, you're bringing one movie, what are you taking with you?
Ooh.
You know, you're going to be there for a while. You're going to be there for a few months, and that's the only thing you can listen to, only thing you can watch, and you're not going to get tired of it.
So the album, this is kind of a cheat, but the... Oh, no! Yeah, I'm going to say it. The album that I would take is Madonna's Immaculate Collection, because I'm gay, and I have no other choice.
It's a pretty diverse album. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, a lot going on. And then the one movie I would take is probably My Best Friend's Wedding. And then what was the other thing?
Just the album and the movie. That's it. Just, you know, keeping yourself entertained. Now, last couple of questions. You got a DeLorean. Your crews are back. 16-year-old Chris, what are you going to tell him? If you've got, you know, an hour to sit down with younger you, what are you going to tell him?
Oh,
words of advice.
Start sooner? Yeah.
That's great advice for anybody. With that is the idea that, you know, start now, at least get going, do it.
Don't be afraid. Don't listen to what people don't, you know, I think things worked out the way they were supposed to, but I would tell my 16-year-old self to start now. Yeah.
Very nice. And then the last question. Now we catch up with you years from now, and they get the documentary of your life coming out because you're fabulously famous, wealthy, hopefully. And you remember us small people down the line, of course. But who would you like to have narrate the documentary of your life?
Oh, I have two because I really love both of their voices for different reasons. So whoever made it to the voiceover booth and that was still around because they're both older than me, Giovanni Ribisi and Delroy Lindo. I'm obsessed with
Nice choices. There. Very good. Yeah, actually, I think Giovanni Ribisi, he's narrated a couple things I've heard before.
He narrated The Virgin Suicides, which is a very...
I knew there was something he did. Yep. And you know, actually, one of my favorite characters he ever did, it's one of my favorite movies, Sofia Coppola. I'm drawing a blank here, in Japan.
Lost in Translation. Yeah.
Lost in Translation is one of my favorite movies ever. His character was just like, he wasn't in a big part of the movie, but it's just something, anything he's in, I'm going to watch, you know. Yeah. But hey, my friend, I want to thank you for taking the time to just sit down and chat, a little talk and story. Again, the movie, The Estate on Hulu. You got to catch it. It's fun. I recommend a nice bottle of wine, maybe some carbs. Sure, you know, just make an evening of it, certainly. But I want to thank you. It was really kind of you to take some time with me on a Friday, nonetheless. But I wish you nothing but health, happiness, prosperity. I know great things are coming from you, and hopefully we'll have a chance to catch up down the line.
I appreciate this so much, and thank you for your support, and thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Well, there you go, Chris Baker. What a cool chat. Really enjoyed it. You know, the people that are out there in the world creating their thing, getting it out there, it's very inspirational. Whether it be writing a book, a song, a screenplay, a movie, whatever, if you are a creative type, I don't care what you're doing, keep on doing it. And, you know, Chris is a prime example. If you do it and you just kind of stick to it, cool things can happen without a doubt. Once again, the movie is called The Estate. It is on Hulu. A little something different than you're probably used to seeing. Once again, The Estate on Hulu. The next few episodes, oh man, we got some cool guests coming up. Hey, I'm going to get on out of here. You have yourself a killer rest of the week. Be safe. And we'll check you out next week right here on Story and Craft.
That's it for this episode of Story and Craft. Join Mark next week for more conversation right here on Story and Craft. Story and Craft is a presentation of Mark Preston Productions, LLC. Executive producer is Mark Preston. Associate producer is Zachary Holden. Please rate and review Story and Craft on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to show updates and stay in the know. Just head to storyandcraftpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Emma Dillon. See you next time, and remember, keep telling your story. Come on.